Welcome to the official podcast of the San Francisco Shakespeare Festival. The following talk, an unusual romance, love, lust, and negotiation in William Shakespeare's The Taming of the Shrew, was held on Wednesday, May 21st, 2014, at the Redwood City Library. It features artistic director Rebecca J. Ennals, resident artist Sean Garahan, and guest artist Anna Marie McLeod.
This is my first year directing Free Shakespeare in the Park. I've been with the company for 12 seasons, but this is my first time doing the big show. And when I thought about what I wanted to do, I knew that I wanted to do The Taming of the Shrew because it is one of my absolute favorite plays. And of course, my feminist friends say, why do you like this play? It's a terrible play. It's a very sexist play. And I say to them, yes, it is. It is a very sexist play. I'm going to say that right off the bat. It's a sexist play. It is also a very subversive and feminist play. And I think that the key to understanding Shakespeare and what Shakespeare is doing is to be able to hold two totally contradictory ideas in your head at the same time. Because so often this very commercial writer who was writing for money at a time when he had to write things that the company and the public wanted him to write was also having ideas that nobody had had before and going places that no one had gone before. So he was trying to do both things at once. He needed to collect a paycheck, he needed to sell tickets, and he also wanted to explore things that were brand new that weren't happening anywhere else in theater. So keep that in your head as we go forward. It's yes, it's sexist. It's also not. So there we go. How many of you in this room have seen or maybe been in Taming of the Shrew before? You all, most people here have seen it. Oh, wow, it's a good crowd. And maybe the Burton Taylor adaptation or maybe the Sybil Shepherd, Bruce Willis moonlighting episode back in the day. So yeah, I talk about those and people sort of think, well, this is not a very romantic play. There's a lot of, you know, fighting, so it's not very romantic. And I beg to differ. I think this is actually one of the most romantic plays that Shakespeare ever wrote, and I think it is because it's about a negotiation between two adults who have very strong personalities, who have to figure out a way to live together, and so it's more about real marriage than Romeo and Juliet will ever be. Because if you remember, those people die at the end. This one's already way ahead because they don't. So this is a much more romantic play just because of that. So I'm going to start with a little bit of historical context for you guys. Shakespeare wrote this play in the 1590s. It was early in his career, we think. He was a young playwright. He had just started working for the Lord Chamberlain's men. He wrote it around the same time he wrote The Two Gentlemen of Verona, which is probably his first play, and The Comedy of Errors. These three plays have some important things in common. They're archetypal characters based on Commedia dell'arte. And Commedia dell'arte was the Italian improvisational traveling theaters that would come over to England and do these wonderful scenarios, these plays that were just based on kind of stereotypical situations. And Shakespeare probably saw them. He probably saw them in the countryside in Stratford, where he grew up. Because we see very specifically there are characters in these plays based on the archetypes in Commedia dell'arte. That's a whole other lecture, so I'm not going to do that one today. But we know, we date it, and we know that some of the same characters are going on there. At this time in the 1590s, Elizabethan England believed in the divine right of sovereigns. And this meant that if you were the sovereign, like Queen Elizabeth, you were never wrong. Everything you did was right because God had decided that you were the sovereign, and so therefore you were the direct hand of God. Everything you did was right. Similarly, they also had the divine right of husbands. This meant that if you were the husband, if you were the man in the relationship, everything you did was right. And you could punish your wife without taking her to trial, without bringing a lawsuit. You could just punish her for whatever crime you perceived, and she would just have to go with it. So that was the divine right of husbands. Now, because we have on the one hand Elizabeth the Queen, and we have on the other hand male husbands, we have this slightly tricky thing going on in this culture at this time. It's like, how does this woman, who is apparently infallible, how does she end up infallible when all these other women are so fallible that their husbands can just punish them for no reason and they have no rights? So we've got a very kind of wonky situation going on. And so we see we're in a time of transition. This is an increasingly secular world, a world in which the church had held sway over everything for so long, and now we were starting to get some secular ideas coming in. We also had, again, a woman as the most powerful person in the land, which was really unsettling for the patriarchy. And we also had this new idea of marrying for love. So marrying for love had not come up much before. It was marrying for money, for property. It was a business transaction. And really popular right at this time period started to get to be this idea that you should actually love the person you're going to spend the rest of your life with. And so So many of the plays of this period focus on that because it was a pretty new idea. So this other idea that came up was this idea that the best homes and the best families are managed by mutual partnership. This is obviously an idea that is still revolutionary for some people now. So this was a really big idea that actually that was the best way to go. And this was all very new at the time. So we're in this real period of transition. Because I'm the library, I'm going to try and sell you on a book, because this is a really good book. This is Germaine Greer, a big feminist thinker who wrote a book called Shakespeare's Wife. And in this book, she talks a lot about what it was like to be a real wife during this period by looking at some of the facts that we know about Anne Shakespeare, Shakespeare's wife's life, as well as her neighbors there in Stratford. And it's a lot more like kind of the Merry Wives of Windsor, the Merry Wives of Stratford, than any of these sort of pampered, ladylike creatures that Kate sort of talks about in the play. So these women worked really hard. They were not protected from hard work, which is something that comes up in the final speech that we'll hear. They were not protected from labor. They worked hard. They didn't get to lie warm and safe, secure and sound, the way that the play says. They made major financial contributions to their marriages through dowries, property, and work. They managed money. They often assisted in their husbands' financial transactions. We have letters where they sent to their husbands in London who were working there, and like the things that they needed to bring back so that they could be sold in town. So they were becoming business partners. They had close-knit communities of women, especially if their husbands were working out of town. These were called their gossips. These were their best girlfriends, and they were often closer to them than their husbands. And they were politically engaged. This is one of my favorite stories that I've learned from this book. So this is a little later on, like around 1607, there was something going on called the Enclosure of the Commons. And that was when public land that it had been, all the people could bring in their sheep and their goats and their horses and bring them in, put them on this public land. Well, the lords of the manor used to start to enclose those commons and remove the rights of anyone but to use them except for themselves, and they would put their own stuff there, and they would build fences around them. Well, they would do this in the middle of the night so that nobody would protest. Well, a lot of middle-class women in Stratford and elsewhere would actually go and camp out in these fields to prevent the enclosure from happening. This was the first Occupy movement. So, and it was women doing this, and they were middle-class women. They were not, you know, women that you would expect to engage in this behavior. We think maybe Shakespeare's own daughter might have been one of the women who did this. So this was quite a political movement happening at the time. And the various authorities didn't even know what to do to punish these women, because you couldn't put nice middle-class ladies in jail. That was not okay. So it was a very tricky thing there. So we've got these women who are starting to have more and more rights. So we're in a really transitional time, and the husbands are on shaky ground. If women are real people with real abilities, then the whole divine right structure is in question. The accepted worldview is going to fall apart. So what happens? Somebody has to write some propaganda asserting the patriarchy, asserting male dominance. And as if you've ever been on a feminist blog and read the comments, you can see what happens whenever anyone decides that women should have more rights. You get a backlash immediately. So we know that there's some source material about shrews of this period. We have Chaucer has mention of shrews. There's a Thomas Heywood's play, The Merry Play, which has a bit of a shrew component. And we hear tell of other anonymous shrew plays. We don't have copies of them anymore, but there were plays in repertoires of theater companies that were about shrews. It was a sort of known concept. The direct source of Shakespeare's The Taming of the Shrew is a ballad called A Merry Jest of a Shrewd and Cursed Wife Lapped in Moral Skin for Her Good Behavior. This is a terrible, terrible ballad. It's just awful. Basically, this woman is married to this guy, and she scolds him and is rude to him, and he decides that he's going to kill his horse, flay his horse's skin off him, salt it, beat her with a whip. When she's all bleeding and miserable, he's going to wrap her in the salted horse's hide until she shuts up. So this is the source material for The Taming of the Shrew. This sounds lovely, right? I've read this whole ballad. It is the worst thing I've ever read. It's appalling. So it's a really violent, really nasty situation where, again, the whole goal, many of these shrew plays, the whole goal was to make the woman suffer and shut up. She couldn't talk. We didn't want women to talk. They were always talking. We didn't want them to talk. So they often end up gagged at the end of the play, which is considered great success. So after this, The Taming of the Shrew comes out, a little different from the source material. And then in the years following, we get Ben Jonson's play Epicene, which was much more often called The Silent Women at that time, which is also about silencing women. And then a couple decades go by, and in about 1609, we get a play by a guy named John Fletcher. And John Fletcher knew Shakespeare really well. They collaborated on a number of plays before Shakespeare retired, and then John Fletcher took over as the chief playwright of the Lord Chamberlain's Men, which are now called the King's Men, when Shakespeare retired. So John Fletcher was also, you know, he was kind of a subversive dude. He probably lived in an openly gay relationship with Francis Beaumont, who he collaborated with, so he's a subversive guy for the time period. And he actually takes Taming of the Shrew and he writes a sequel called The Tamer Tamed. And it's based a little bit on Aristophanes' Lysistrata, where the women say, we're not going to take it anymore, and so we're going to withhold certain things from you until you come around to our way of thinking. So that play seems to have been quite successful and was running for a long time until the Victorians took over. So that was in about 1609. So those are the sort of the history of shrew plays as we go along through time. I will say that Tamer Tamed used to very rarely be performed, and now we're starting to see it come back into the repertoire. It's very, very funny, and we're going to do a reading of it at SF Shakes as well this summer. So imagine Shakespeare in the 1580s, early 1590s. He married for love, we think. He married very, very young, at only 18, to a woman who was 26. 26 was a very normal age to get married. 18 was really young at this time period. It wasn't like Juliet getting married at 13. You didn't get married at 18. So he got married to an older woman whose family was much more financially stable than his and much higher social status. So she was not a desperate spinster. She could have done just fine. For some reason, she married this 18-year-old whose family was a disaster. His father was in debt, losing money. He didn't know what he wanted to do with his life. He didn't really want to go work for his dad. His dad didn't really want to work for himself. His dad kept spending his mother's money, her inheritance, and things were sketchy with the law. He owed people stuff, and may have been a secret Catholic. All this stuff was going on. So anyway, he got out of there. He married Anne Hathaway. We don't really know what happened then. His own prospects might have been a little bit dim, and his family was broke, at some point he goes to London. Well, Anne Hathaway's family had theatrical connections, so there's a pretty good possibility that he got that job because of her. So he goes off to London, and we don't hear from him again until we hear from him with the Lord Chamberlain's men. But we're pretty sure that it's along the way here, his wife is probably working to support the family. They got three kids. She's probably selling malt, selling beer, doing the stuff that the local women in Stratford did to take care of themselves when their husbands were off doing something else. As a young playwright, the Lord Chamberlain's men, run by Richard Burbage, commissions Shakespeare to write plays early on in the process. He gets to do Shrew, and he has some success with Shrew. It seems to have gone well. And it suggests that he's getting better. So we suppose that maybe the Lord Chamberlain's men did that because they wanted to have a shrew play in the repertoire, and maybe Richard Burbage, I kind of imagine, shows up with the source material, this horrifying ballad, and says, let's do an adaptation of this. And then maybe he goes, oh my God, okay, how am I going to make this work? And so he takes this play, and he's both faithful to the source material, and he totally subverts it at the same time, which we will look at. And if I will say, before we get into looking at those scenes, that if the shrew were just a piece of sexist propaganda, like The Merry Jest or Ben Jonson's The Silent Woman, then I wouldn't want to direct it, and I don't think that anyone would want to perform in it, and probably nobody would want to see it. There's a reason that you don't hear, you know, musical adaptations of The Merry Jest being played all over the place. But it is fascinating to look at the relationship there because of its subtlety and the hints of a deeper negotiation between the lovers, Kate and Petruchio, and how Shakespeare took something that was so beyond the pale in terms of the violent relationship and made it so much more subtle and so much more romantic. So, with that, I want to look at some key scenes in the play, and we'll talk a little bit about how the relationship evolves and how, again, it is both a sexist and a not sexist relationship. So, has anyone ever seen a production of Shrew that includes the Christopher Sly induction scenes? Yeah, Shakespeare's Santa Cruz did it that way last year, so if you saw that. These are very rarely performed. And what it is kind of a play within the play structure. So we introduce a character called Christopher Sly, he shows up at an inn, and he watches a play called The Taming of the Shrew. Again, it's often cut, it doesn't really hurt the core play not to do it, but it's very interesting to do it because the first shrew that shows up in The Taming of the Shrew is a man, and he's behaving rudely and abusively to a female, powerful female business owner. So, these are my two actors for today. Sean Garahan is a resident artist with us, and Anna Marie McLeod, who is an actress with us, but we're in Henry V here in Redwood City. And they're going to start with a little bit of Christopher Sly and the innkeeper.
Oh, Fesian faith.
Pair of stocks, you rogue.
You're a baggage. The Slys are no rogues. Look in the Chronicles. We came in with Richard Conqueror. Therefore, Pocus Palabras. Let the world slide. Sessa.
You will not pay for the glasses you've burst?
No, not a cent. Go by St. Geronimo. Go to thy cold bed and warm thee.
So, this drunk guy, Christopher Sly, passes out on stage. There he goes. And so, meanwhile, another character enters as a lord. In our production, it'll be played by a woman. So, again, we have some women play, and the same actress who plays Kate will play this character. And shows up, sees this drunk guy, and is like, you know what, let's play a little trick on this drunk guy. And she says this.
Monstrous beast. How like a swine he lies. Friends, I will practice on this drunken man. What think you, if he were conveyed to bed, wrapped in sweet clothes, rings put upon his fingers, a most delicious banquet by his bed, and brave attendants near him when he wakes, would not the beggar then forget himself?
So we have this idea now of pretending that someone is something that they are not, and setting them up in a sort of jokey situation where we, by treating them a certain way, we think maybe that they will start behaving a different way. Well, this happens again later in the play with Kate. So we have this Christopher Sly. This lord is going to treat Christopher Sly really, really well and treat him like he's a lord and see if that changes his behavior. Maybe it will. Also, a couple other points in there. She calls him a swine. The animal analogies kind of go crazy in this play. Kate often gets called a shrew, but she even more often gets called a haggard, a female hawk. A more powerful kind of animal. We also see from this example that powerlessness is tied to more than gender in this play, that we have powerlessness tied to a male character who is poor, who is a beggar, and who is drunk and has some mental problems. So we see that not every shrew is necessarily female. We also have later on in this scene, the lord brings in Bartholomew the page, who is a young man who works for him, and he dresses Bartholomew up as a woman and suggests to Christopher Sly that this is his wife. And so we see through this situation that marriage is something that men arrange and that men participate in, because we have two male characters supposedly married to each other, and that maybe women can be fooled into behaving a certain way because men can behave like women, so therefore why can't women behave like this wife character as well? So wife behavior is something that can be learned, that can be taken on. It is not natural, but some guy can do it. You know, this boy can do it. So we have that happening. The big idea here is this idea of this, that I pointed out first, which is that I like to call opposite day, where you decide to deliberately treat someone the opposite way that they deserve to be treated, or everything that they say, you decide you're going to interpret it the opposite. Well, that becomes very, very important later on. Petruchio uses this as a primary tactic. So that's the induction. They watch the first scene of the play. Petruchio's not in it. Christopher Sly falls asleep during the play. He's still kind of drunk. And then the next character to enter is Petruchio. Because of this, a lot of us, me included, will double the characters of Christopher Sly and Petruchio, and this is the lord character that perhaps Christopher Sly is dreaming that he is. And so he shows up in town. He wakes up, shows up in town, and he announces his intentions to marry for money in the old school kind of way. He's going to marry for money. He's going to marry for property. And here's what he says.
Signor Hortensio, twixt such friends as we, few words suffice. And therefore, if thou know one rich enough to be Petruchio's wife, as wealth is burthen of my wooing dance, be she as foul as was Florentius' love, as old as Sibyl, and as cursed and shrewd as Socrates' Antipe, or a worse, she moves me not, or not removes at least affection's edge in me. Were she as rough as are the swelling Adriatic seas, I come to wive it wealthily in Padua. If wealthily, then happily in Padua.
So he comes and he's pretty cocky. He thinks it's going to be fine. It doesn't matter how bad she is. I can take care of her. I just want the money. I'm just, no big deal. So again, this is this old idea. Well, then Kate's dad, Baptista, says, oh no, you first have to win her love. And again, he says, that's fine. I can do that. So then, of course, Kate has this problem. She has this belief brought on her by her father, by her sister, that she is unlovable. And so she says this.
What, will you not suffer me? Nay, now I see. She is your treasure. She must have a husband. I must dance barefoot on her wedding day, and for your love to her, lead apes in hell. Talk not to me. I will go sit and weep till I can find occasion of revenge.
So she is not going to play the game. She does not want to be anything but what she is, and she does not do as well as her sister, Bianca, does in the love department. So Petruchio is about to encounter this woman, and he has a moment alone on stage, one of just a couple in the show, where he talks to the audience to get some feedback on exactly how he's going to go about wooing Kate. And here's what he says.
I pray you do. I'll attend her here and woo her with some spirit when she comes. Say that she rail. Why then, I'll tell her plain, she sings as sweetly as a nightingale. Say that she frown. I'll say she looks as clear as morning roses, newly washed with dew. Say she be mute and will not speak a word. Then I'll commend her volubility and say she uttereth piercing eloquence. If she do bid me pack, I'll give her thanks, as though she bid me stay by her a week. If she deny to wed, I'll crave the day when I shall ask the banns, and when be married. But here she comes, and now Petruchio speak.
Cool. So, again, just to point out, he's engaging in that opposite day idea. She does this, I'm going to do the opposite. She does this, I'm going to do the opposite. By treating her really well, like we treated Christopher Sly, I'm going to see if that'll change her behavior and make her behave better. Of course, then she appears, and she's even worse than anyone could have imagined.
Good morrow, Kate, for that's your name, I hear.
Well, have you heard, but something hard of hearing. They call me Catherine, that do talk of me.
You lie, in faith, for you are called plain Kate, and bonny Kate, and sometimes Kate the cursed, but Kate the prettiest Kate in all of Christendom. Kate of Kate Hall, my super dainty Kate, for dainties are all Kates, and therefore, Kate, take this one of me, Kate of my consolation. Hearing thy mildness, praised in every town, thy virtue spoke of, and thy beauty sounded, yet not so deeply as to thee belongs, myself am moved to woo thee for my wife.
Moved, in good time. Let him that moved you hither remove you hence. I knew you at the first. You were a movable.
Why? What's a movable?
A joined stool.
Thou hast hit it. Come, sit on me.
Asses were made to bear, and so are you.
Women are made to bear, and so are you.
No such jade as you, if me you mean.
Alas, good Kate, I will not burthen thee, for knowing thee to be but young and light.
Too light for such a swain as you to catch, and yet as heavy as I should be.
Should be? Should buzz.
Well, tame, and like a buzzard.
Oh, slow-winged turtle, shall a buzzard take thee?
Aye, for a turtle, as he takes a buzzard.
Come, come, you wasp, if faith you are too angry.
If I be waspish, best beware my sting.
Oh, my remedy is then to pluck it out.
Aye, if the fool could find it where it lies.
Who knows not where a wasp does wear his sting? In his tail.
In his tongue.
Whose tongue?
Yours, if you talk of tails, and so farewell.
What? With my tongue in your tail? Nay, come again, good Kate. I am a gentleman.
That I'll try.
But I'm going to stop him before she hits him. So this is, the minute he sees her, things change up a little bit, because here this gets a little sexy. It kind of gets a little playful and fun. They start to have a good time with these little word games they start to play. And, of course, it gets a little shocking for her, and she resorts to violence, as she often does. We can't really, at this point, believe that anymore that this guy ever wants a submissive wife. He's having way too much fun with this. So that idea is off the table. He doesn't want a submissive wife. He wants this wife. And she's just so damaged. I don't think she knows what she wants at this point. But she's also, again, so violent. It's really important to point out that she engages in physical violence throughout the play. She's always hitting people, beating them up, tying them up. He never lays a finger on her, as the stage directions that Shakespeare has provided do not indicate that. He beats up a servant. He beats up a lesser person to perhaps show the at that time certainly the hierarchy of what was appropriate, but he wouldn't touch his wife. And so this is very different from earlier Shrew stories and extremely different from Mary Jest, is that Shakespeare just removes that whole thing. We don't have any violence against this woman. She is the only instigator of violence, and part of it is teaching her not to be violent. So part of that teaching is Petruchio's taming school, is his series of tactics to kind of get her to get on the same page with him so that they can have this relationship, because clearly he's not going to be able to be married to this. So the first tactic he uses is back to this opposites thing, and this is what happens when her dad, Baptista, comes back into the room with a group of guys, and here's what he says.
Be patient, gentlemen. I choose her for myself. If she and I be pleased, what's that to you? 'Tis bargained twixt us twain, being alone, that she shall still be cursed in company. I tell you, 'tis incredible to believe how much she loves me. Oh, the kindest Kate, she hung about my neck, and kiss on kiss she vied so fast, protesting oath on oath, that in a twink she won me to her love. Oh, you are novices! 'Tis a world to see how tame, when men and women are alone, a meacock wretch can make the cursedest shrew. Give me thy hand, Kate. I will unto Venice to buy apparel against the wedding day, provide the feast, father, and bid the guests. I will be sure my Catherine shall be fine.
Good. So he's been calling her Kate all this time, but she hates him, and then calls her Catherine at the end, throws her a bone. So he goes off to Venice to get all the wedding clothes, and then he shows up at the wedding, and this is tactic number two. He engages in totally inappropriate, rude, and embarrassing behavior at the wedding. He shows up completely appallingly dressed. His servant is also appallingly dressed. They come in late. They drag Kate away from her own wedding feast early. He, like, knocks over the priest. It's all terrible. And so I think what he's trying to do here is he's demonstrating how rude behavior affects the community around you. So she's never really seen what it's like to be on the other side of that kind of behavior, and now suddenly here she is with this guy who behaves much worse than she does in public. Also, it makes her look really good. Everyone starts talking about how she's got nothing on this guy. She actually looks like a really nice young lady at this point. So he's turned it around, made her look like a better person as well. So that's tactic number two. We won't do that scene because there's a million people in it. Third tactic, he gets her back to his house. And at this point, he starts the stuff that's probably the most controversial in the play for those of us who don't like this idea, which is pretty much everyone. He starts to deprive her of food and sleep. Well, it doesn't seem to go very well, and this is what he says after. This is, again, he's alone on stage for the audience with for the second time, and he again needs their help. So here he is.
Thus have I politically begun my reign, and 'tis my hope to end successfully. She ate no meat today, nor none shall eat. Last night she slept not, nor tonight she shall not. As with the meat, some undeserved fault I'll find about the making of the bed. And here I'll fling the pillow, there the bolster, this way the coverlet, another way the sheets. Aye, and amid this hurly, I intend that all is done in reverend care of her. And in conclusion, she shall watch all night, and if she chance to nod, I'll rail and brawl, and with the clamor keep her still awake. This is a way to kill a wife with kindness, and thus I'll curb her mad and headstrong humor. He that knows better how to tame a shrew, now let him speak. 'Tis charity to show.
And sometimes the audience will be like, oh! Yeah, so this is Petruchio. He's alone on stage, and he has been, it's really important to know this as a director and as actors going to the scene, he hasn't eaten either. He hasn't slept either. So every time he deprives her of sleep, he has to stay up to do it. Every time he throws the food on the floor, he doesn't get to eat it either. So he's just as miserable as she is, and the whole thing is not going well. And as he says, I don't know what else to do at this point. This is the only kind of tactic that I have, and it's really not working out. She hates him at this point. She can't stand the sight of him. He, meanwhile, seems like it starts to matter to him that she loves him. He starts to love her. And so he more than ever wants to succeed in what he's doing. So we get to tactic number four. Now, first of all, this goes down the same kind of road as this food and sleep deprivation at first. He has a tailor come in, and a haberdasher with a beautiful dress and a beautiful cap, and then he takes those away from her. And his point seems to be to teach her that it doesn't matter what you wear, what's important is what's on the inside. This doesn't really go over very well with her. She actually reacts extremely badly to this further deprivation of things that she loves, and she says the following speech.
Why, sir, I trust I may have leave to speak, and speak I will. I am no child, no babe. Your betters have endured me, say my mind, and if you cannot, best stop your ears. My tongue will tell the anger of my heart, or else my heart concealing it will break. And rather than it shall, I will be free, even to the uttermost as I please in words.
This is a really important moment when she says this, and I think that Petruchio hears this. She says, I will be free in words. So you're not going to shut me up. I don't care what you do to me, what you deprive me of. I will speak, and I'm never going to shut up. Well, in the context of all these other shrew stories, this is incredibly important. Nobody gets to tell. Nobody gets to talk. The women don't get to say what they want to say. This woman declares here, right in the middle of the play, right in the center of the play, I am not going to shut up, ever. And Petruchio hears this, and at this point forward, he stops all this sleep deprivation, all this food deprivation, and all this clothing deprivation, and he starts to think about words. And I think he goes back to that early little scene where they had together, and they've had so much fun playing with words, and he thinks, oh, how can we play with some words together? That might be the way in, but she's got to get on the same page with me. She's got to agree with me. She's got to be there with me. So the fifth tactic is what is a wordplay tactic, and it's the sun and the moon. And this is the scene they have together on their way back to Padua, to her father's house.
Come on, God's name, once more towards our fathers. Good Lord, how bright and goodly shines the moon.
The moon? The sun? It is not moonlight now.
I say it is the moon that shines so bright.
I know it is the sun that shines so bright.
Now by my mother's sun, and that's myself, it shall be moon, or star, or what I list, or ere I journey to your father's house. Go on. And fetch our horses back again. Evermore crossed and crossed, nothing but crossed.
Forward, I pray, since we have come so far, and be it moon or sun or what you please, and if you please to call it a rush candle, henceforth I vow it shall be so for me.
I say it is the moon.
I know it is the moon.
Nay, then you lie. It is the blessed sun.
Then God be blessed, it is the blessed sun. But sun it is not, when you say it is not, and the moon changes even as your mind. What you will have it named, even that it is, and so shall it be for Catherine.
So at this point she agrees, probably just because she's tired and wants to go forward, but then they come across this old man, and she starts to have some fun. She starts to call him a young woman, everyone has a good laugh, the old man thinks it's pretty funny as well, they all travel along together, so they start to have some fun. And at the end of this scene, Petruchio says, kiss me, Kate, that famous lovely line, and she's a little embarrassed to do this in the middle of the street, but she agrees to do it, and at that point, she kisses him voluntarily for the very first time, and there's something pivotal happening. We think as an audience that maybe this is the moment where things are starting to get better, but we're not totally sure, and it's important that we're not totally sure, because what happens next is the test. So they are at the wedding. This is the wedding of Bianca, this is Kate's sister, to Lucentio. It's also it's a double wedding. It's also Hortensio and his wife are getting married. And in this very public space, the women have all left the room. They've gone off to go sit by the fire. And in this very public space, the men do this shameful bet, where they're going to take money and bet on whose wife is the most obedient and the most faithful. So they all agree that their wives are going to perform the behavior of a perfect wife. Well, Hortensio and Lucentio send out for their wives, and they're both like, we're not going to come when you call us, that's ridiculous. And so we're not coming. And Petruchio sends his servant out and says, I command Kate to come here to me. Like, and imagine Kate in the other room going like, what is he up to now? This is interesting. All right, I'll come. You know. So she comes in, she's told to come. She's like, all right, it's like sun and the moon. I do what you say. That's all right. See what happens. And so she shows up, which is to the immense surprise of everyone in the room, especially her father. And now Petruchio has won the bet. And he says, that's not enough. It's not just that I've won the bet because she came because she's curious about what I want. I'm going to have her do more. Here's the spotlight, Kate. Here's the floor. Tell these other women what duty their wives owe their husbands. Here you go. Total freedom. I'm not going to dictate what you say. You can say whatever you want and no one will shut you up. So here she goes.
Knit that threatening, unkind brow, and dart not scornful glances from those eyes to wound thy lord, thy king, thy governor. It blots thy beauty as the frosts do bite the meads, confounds thy fame as whirlwinds shake fair buds, and in no sense is meet or amiable. A woman moved is like a fountain, troubled, muddy, ill-seeming, thick, bereft of beauty, and while it is so, none so dry or thirsty will deign to sip or touch one drop of it. Thy husband is thy lord, thy life, thy keeper, thy head, thy sovereign, one that cares for thee, and for thy maintenance commits his body to painful labor, both by sea and land, to watch the night in storms, the day in cold, while thou liest
warm at home, secure and safe, and craves no other tribute at thy hands but love, fair looks, and true obedience. Too little payment for so great a debt.
And it goes on and on and on for a long, long time. And yes, the content of this speech is very conventional. It's Book of Common Prayer. It's biblical. It is exactly what Daddy wants to hear her say. It is exactly what these other two women are going, oh, fine, Miss Perfect, which she's never been before in her life. And so it's this extremely conventional speech. But what's unconventional about it is the length of it and the fact that no one interrupts for, I think she talks for at least 5 minutes without interruption. No other female character in Shakespeare gets to talk this much in Act 5. This is the longest Act 5 speech of a female character in Shakespeare. And it's such so early in Shakespeare's career that this happens. He's got heroines later who, as soon as they get married, they never speak another word. This woman gets to talk for this long. And so on the one hand, she delivers a speech that by modern standards, we're like, that's not what we think anymore. However, the fact that she does it for so long and that she gets to talk at all, that's where we get this feminist, very subversive work from Shakespeare. So we have both things existing simultaneously. And if you go into the language a little bit and work on the interpretation of this, there's a lot of things going on in this speech. There's some major revenge against these two other women who have really treated her extremely badly. There's some satire because, as I mentioned before, this business about women sitting at home and safe and sound while the man is toiling away, Shakespeare knew very, very well that his wife wasn't sitting at home doing nothing. Also, she's saying this to a bunch of landed gentry who haven't worked a day in their lives. Their husbands aren't out doing anything particularly difficult. They have to go to court and wait on the king. They're not doing anything hard. Petruchio has been a soldier, so arguably he has actually done some difficult work in his life. But these other guys, Lucentio and Hortensio, it's nonsense. So Shakespeare knows it's nonsense. He knows it's convention. He knows it's a speech that is being delivered for the benefit of the father and for the wedding guests. It's not all really, really true to him. To her, so we know that. So at the end of this speech, of course it's amazing, and Baptista is thrilled and doubles the money that Petruchio is already winning, so they end up with a ton of money at the end of the play, so that's a pretty happy ending. Big old honeymoon for them. So that's where we leave Kate and Petruchio. The other guys looking at their wives going, we're going to have a really difficult time, and these two looking at their marriage and going, like, we've worked this out. We've negotiated something, and we can really believe at the end that Kate actually loves this guy, and we've not been really sure up until this point, but at the end we know. And that's where Shakespeare's folio version of The Taming of the Shrew ends. We don't know what happened to good old Christopher Sly passed out on the stage. We never find out in the folio version. But there's this other version called The Taming of a Shrew. We don't know when it was written exactly. It might have been an earlier anonymous shrew play that then Shakespeare used as source material. It's also quite likely it was one of those bad quartos where people would sit in the audience and like take notes and then go back and write their own plays based on it, because it was very, very, it's kind of like when you get people illegally recording movies these days. It's like the pirating of the time. So it might have been a pirated copy of Taming of the Shrew called Taming of a Shrew. And so it actually has a Christopher Sly scene at the end. So we think maybe it actually did. We just don't have it in the folio. And so this is the scene that happens at the end of The Taming of a Shrew. And we are going to do a bit of this as part of our production of Free Shakespeare in the Park.
How fares my noble lord?
Who is this? Tapster? Oh, I have had the bravest dream tonight that ever thou heardest in all thy life. Where is my wife?
Your wife will curse you for dreaming here tonight.
Will she? I know now how to tame a shrew. I dreamt upon it all this night till now, and thou hast waked me out of the best dream that ever I had in my life. But I'll to my wife presently, and tame her too, and if she anger me.
Nay, tarry, Sly. I'll go home with thee, and hear the rest that thou hast dreamt tonight.
Good. So we have, again, our Tapster character, who's the same as the innkeeper, and Christopher Sly waking up. And he wakes up in fear of being scolded by his real wife. So he's looking around for where's Katharina, and he's very concerned that he might get scolded by his real life wife. And I don't think we ever really believe that he can truly tame this real life wife, this kind of sad drunk guy. So we're back to the reality of this is this is real world where husbands and wives are much more equal, women have a lot more power, and a guy like Christopher Sly can only dream of the sort of money and success that Petruchio might have. So it kind of takes him off of that pedestal and puts him back in that real world. We're going to change it. We're not going to do the scene exactly verbatim because I want to preserve a little idea at the end that maybe these two people might be able to negotiate their own relationship of equals, and we're setting our production scenes in the present day. So that's going to be, you'll see how we do that at Free Shakespeare in the Park, but we'll use the text from those induction scenes. So, in conclusion, this play was written, as I mentioned before, at a very pivotal moment in history, a moment when women were finding their way in the world in a different sort of way than they had before, and men were finding ways in which they were going to engage with them equally. And I think we're very much at a similar kind of moment today as we see things going before Congress about equal pay and all this stuff. So I think that this is one of the great reasons to do this show now and to watch this show now is hopefully we'll open up some conversations about the genders and the differences between us and how we can get along and negotiate in this world. And I think, you know, as well, it's incredibly funny and incredibly romantic, and I would like to share that with you as well. We have a few minutes for any questions or thoughts that you might have about the play, about our production, about San Francisco Shakespeare Festival. If you have anything at all you'd like to say, any comments, any thoughts, then we've got a few more minutes in which we'd love to hear them. So, yeah, John.
I didn't get why they did Tactic 3 again, where he's like starving her and keeping her up. What was the purpose of that again?
I think the idea was that she would be so wiped out with exhaustion that she can't fight anymore. Knock the fight out of her. And this was actually sort of comes from that source material and from other shrew kind of plays, that if you just knock her out physically, then she can't fight you anymore. And so one of the ways to do that is to deprive her of things. And so it's horrible. And
he doesn't really want to knock her out, does he?
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, is I think he's going with sort of conventional ideas about what you did, and it doesn't work, you know, and he doesn't like it either, I don't think.
He tries it, but it doesn't work out.
I don't think it
works. For him or for her.
No, I don't think it does. And I think the problem is that, and a lot of production's problem is that they forget that Petruchio can't keep her awake without being awake himself. And it's such an incredibly important thing to remember that you can't make someone else miserable without making yourself miserable. And so that happens, and it doesn't work well. It's always the stickiest point in the play for me, because they go away from Padua, they're kind of isolated, and then it gets really nasty and abusive. And there were many productions, you know, for years, it was very, in the 70s and 80s, it was very much the done thing to sort of reclaim the Taming of the Shrew for women, to make it a sort of torture porn play, for lack of a better word. It was about, you know, sort of making it be a really depressing, and she was just beaten down at the end, and we had a very sad ending. So that's one choice. I think sort of theatrically and culturally we've done that, we kind of had to for a while, now we've sort of moved past it, and I think we can do new things with the play that really take into account that it's actually meant to be a comedy, and if you do that with it, it really is not funny anymore, and it's really not any fun. So how to keep the comedy there is important.
May I ask a history question that kind of tags onto that? Mm-hmm. That I've heard something before from dramaturgs, and it may not be accurate, so I'd like to check it with you because it addresses that, which is she's called a haggard, which is a mm-hmm. female hawk, yeah. And I was told that he references this play talking about how I'm going to tame her as I would tame a haggard, yeah. And that people of the time would have been very familiar with hunting with hawks, yeah. Mm. And that it was, in fact, the case that when you're starting off a new hawk, the human who's teaching the hawk doesn't eat until that hawk successfully yeah. catches something and brings it back and is fed.
That is true. And he talks about, specifically has the language about you taming the hawk using food. So he's doing similar things with her. The idea is to use food. She's not a hawk, and I think that's where it doesn't work out, is that she can't be tamed that way. But it is, I mean, it's a fairly respectful language in terms of, like, she's a very powerful creature who needs to, you know, I need to bring her under my sway, and how am I going to do this? So he doesn't really think of her as a small nasty rodent. He thinks of her as this powerful hawk creature. Yes.
In Shakespeare's time, all the female parts were played by men.
That's right.
Why? What was the reason for that, and what would be the feminist reaction to that?
I think it's really interesting actually, because it does change the plays so completely when you see all men perform them. I just saw the Globe's Twelfth Night in Richard III on Broadway, which is all men. And so much of the comedy is different when you've got men doing it. It kind of points out how ridiculous some of this stuff is. So I actually think, and I've never done an all-male production of Taming of the Shrew, but I think that probably the satire would come across more strongly
if you was all men. Music? I mean, there must have been barmaids.
It was just considered to be beyond the pale shameful for women to show themselves in that way in public. It was just not acceptable. The master, there was a guy called the Master of the Revels who was appointed by the queen, and for a very long time it was this hardcore Puritan dude. And so this Puritan guy would not let any women on the stage ever. And they were always getting censored. So plays were really, they could never reference God, and they could never have any women on stage. And it was because of this Puritan sort of ideology that was prevalent in this, he was the sort of company town censor. Eventually got to the point where after Shakespeare's time, they shut down the theaters completely because they were so beyond the pale in terms of presenting immoral behavior on the stage. And if you read The Tamer Tamed, you can see what they're talking about because it's the dirtiest play I've ever written in my life. But it was that balance of, like, we want to have fun, but there's certain things you cannot do, and one of them is put women up there because that will be shameful. I don't really know why. I mean, now it seems crazy, but that was the thinking.
Can you share the setting, the time period and setting you're going to use?
Yeah, absolutely. For our production, what I initially said to the company is that there's so much going on in this play already that there's three, Shakespeare's plays always have at least two settings and probably three. So you both have the period in which it was written, the period we're in now, which is going to inform it whether you want it to or not, and then the third is like that other period that you decide to play it in. So you've kind of potentially got three levels going on at all times. And there are a lot of wonderful productions of Shrew that are set, you know, in the 1950s and the 1910s, and, you know, whenever. I decided that I had enough going on, and I really just wanted to focus on the time we're in now and the time that was when it was written. So I just wanted to do those two. So we've got the induction scene set in the present day, as if you're showing up at Free Shakespeare in the Park, and here you are, and here's our set, and here's our actors getting ready, because there's players in the first scene to show up to do the play. They're warming up. And then you have this house manager character who's running the place, and then you have this drunk guy who wanders in. So, you know, which could happen at Free Shakespeare Park. So you know, it's sort of, we're at Free Shakes. And then we go from there into the world of this Elizabethan play. We're doing Elizabethan. We haven't done Elizabethan in, like, 13 years at Free Shakespeare in the Park, so it's going to be, like, innovative for us to do something that's actually set in that era. We're kind of going back through the costumes and going, wow, we haven't used these in a really long time. So we're going to do that. And it's partially, there's so many references that are so specific to that time, like the Haggard, that I think you have to cut that stuff in the 1950s. It doesn't make any sense at that point. So I wanted to be able to keep all that stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
So I've seen a couple of versions of the play where that final scene is played very differently. One of them that I saw was where Petruchio was playing it as if he realized the error of his ways. And as she is saying all of this stuff about how subservient she is, he's starting to cry on stage, knowing that he's broken the woman that he loves. I've also seen it where they are sort of masters in... they're playing an in-joke on everybody else, where they've got the sly looks at each other like, hey, this is going to play well. Hey, this is going to get me some money. And they played it like that. It looks like you're going for slightly a different version than either of the other two, and I wonder if you could comment on those other versions.
That's a really succinct and good description of, I think, the two ways that it does get approached, is sort of the, oh my god, she's totally destroyed version, and the, this is just kidding, we're just kidding, we're just kidding kind of version. I was in a production that was very much that second thing of, like, we've talked ahead of time and we're totally doing this. And my argument against that is that when did they talk? They didn't know that this was going to happen. And so to me, it sort of undermines the enormous trust in the moment of him saying, I don't really know if I've totally run you over, but go for it and say whatever you're going to say. And then she does actually sort of come through for him in that moment. I think as I go through the speech, and it's such a difficult speech, and everything that I say now will then be completely destroyed by rehearsal when the actors are in the room and figuring a lot of other stuff out that would be way more brilliant. So I think now that there's some genuinely sincere things in there where she says, thank you for being patient with me, and I'm really sorry that I was such a jerk for so long and that I hit you and, you know, generally treated you so badly. So I think she's actually putting her heart out there for him very publicly in this sort of slightly coded way, but it's maybe less coded than an in-joke. Yeah.
How does Petruccio react in your production?
Well, I think, you know, what I get from the text, which is what I can only, the only thing, is the only authority I know, is that he comes out of it going, why, there's a wench. You know, that's what he says afterwards. He's like, that's my gal, you know? Because I think he's surprised. I think he doesn't expect her to go this far. And I think he doesn't expect her to speak so eloquently and beautifully and at such length because she doesn't, like, the only other time he's heard her do that is that whole, I will be free in words. And that's a hint of what she can do. But this is an exceptionally structured speech. It's in perfect iambic pentameter. She never strays from the meter. It is to the letter. And so it's, you know, I think that he's really impressed and happy. And I think that you know, the idea that he's destroyed her, I don't think he has. She's incredibly powerful and confident during this speech. She has the room, there's not a pin drops, and she speaks, and nobody interrupts, and she's in control. So ironically, she's saying she's going to be submissive while she's absolutely not. You know, she's in total control. So I think that he can see the levels there, but he can also see that they no longer have to fight, that they no longer have to get, like everything he says she won't contradict. They can present a united front, they can agree, and they can move forward in this relationship, which is totally also a relationship that is very separate from these fairly unhealthy, damaged people that also exist in this community, like her father, who has treated her so badly for so long. So, you know, I like to think they go off stage and go, and he goes, wow! And she says, yeah, you know, I thought of this and this and this, and this is why I said all that. So I think that it's the beginning for them. It's not the end of the destruction. It's the, oh, she's we can start now. We can have a marriage now. Yeah, hope that answers that. And again, it will totally evolve in rehearsal so much, and it always does. And there'll be like a totally new thing that comes in that I never.
There. Yeah.
Question. Sorry, I had a quick question.
Yeah.
Sort of going off of what we were talking about before. In terms of, I mean, you know, with the satire, how do you handle that? Because I guess there's a worry that someone could take away like that last speech and be like, yes, women should be subservient. That's a good thing that's just been said.
That's one of the reasons I want to add that induction scene at the end, because I think that it gives you a little bit of reflection time, whereas if you end with that speech, I have been in productions where I saw quite a good production last year that I thought really addressed a lot of the issues, and yet at the end, the man in front of me turned to his wife and said, see, that's how you should behave. And I went, oh dear, fail. Because I don't think that's what the director was getting at all. I don't think that's what she wanted people to know. So this induction scene at the end where we bring back these two actors out of costume in the modern day, facing each other and dealing with each other as equals, and he's kind of a sad sack, and she's kind of in a higher status position, and then she comes down to him or brings him up. There's that last line that she says. She says basically, I'll go along with you. Tell me your dream. I want to hear it. I'll go along with you. And I think that'll be the last line in our production. And I think that's important because it's about equality. I'll go along with you. I'm going to walk side by side with you and hear your dream. We only listen to the dreams of our very close friends. So I think that's a really important line of between equals. And that's how I'm. You know, I know that's not the way it was written to be, because this were, you know, this is from this other scene. But for this production, I think this will help us to register that equality at the end. Thank you all so much. If you want to talk further, we'll be cleaning up here, so we'll be up here. But again, thank you so much for being here tonight.
Please be sure to visit us at sfshakes.org. For more information regarding our 2014 Free Shakespeare in the Park production of The Taming of the Shrew, directed by Rebecca J. Ennals.